Brad Card out of the gate leading us off this morning live, Card and Associates, talking about some of the big stuff happening in the Capitol, including a funding bill, the test of the House Speaker, Senate Democrats voting to continue the funding of flying migrants to this country. So, Brad Card, plenty to talk about. Good Monday morning.
Hey, Jack. Good morning.
A lot to talk about. Where do you want to start, the funding bill or where?
Yeah, funding. I mean, look, they finally get the bill done. It was ugly. And it was a horribly long process. And for all the lunatics in D.C. that, you know, went after Kevin McCarthy and got him out, they ended up basically where they would have been anyway. And all the drama that's happened is kind of for naught. But they got that. They got FY 2024 done, and now they got to get FY 2025 done. And so they're going to start working on that as soon as they get back in 2 weeks.
What about the House Speaker? And I know Representative Green was trying to do kind of a repeat of the question of almost like a vote of confidence in a prime minister. Where did that end up?
Well, she filed it. The question is, how is she going to push it? I mean, at the end of the day, she filed the motion to vacate the chair. Mike Gallagher's leaving Congress. They're going to have a one-seat majority, which is not a governing majority for all intents and purposes. You've got some members that are old. You've got some members that may be sick. And if they're not there on a given day, these are just games. It's noise. It's stupid. It's not going to accomplish anything. It's not going to be productive to the Republican Party at all. Jack, and you mentioned some of the amendments that were filed in the Senate. And I see why Fox News and others promote them as being, you know, salacious. And how do you defend flying illegal immigrants from other countries into cities in our, but the place to do it is not in an appropriation bill when you've got a gun against your head to pass these bills and or the government's going to shut down and the House is not in session. So when that happened, Jack, when the Republicans, those amendments were political amendments, and I'm all for politics, I'm all for playing politics. But, I mean, at the end of the day, Jack, that was never real. And quite frankly, it's disingenuous to say that it was real and for anybody to even promote it as if it was a real amendment, because these amendments are filed. If one change happened to that bill, it would have to go back to the House to have the whole House vote on it again. The House was in recess. The House had left. And so it wasn't practical. And even if you called the House back, we would have been in a government shutdown, which cost the government tons of money to shut down. But so it was disingenuous, and for people to get all fired up about these bills and make it like everybody supports this. Look, I'm no fan of Democrats. I'm a Republican. I'm a partisan. But at the end of the day, that was just not real. And it was political.
And that's, you just hit the nail on the head. It is political. It's not rational.
Bring it up as a regular bill. File a bill.
Well, they should. They should. Get it done. They should. Sometimes I think the only time these things make news is when you do these things and add them on or question things. But we'll see where it goes.
You can play it out, Jack. You can play it out with saying to the Republicans in the House, and I'm a Republican. Well, if that bill is so important, why wasn't it pushed by anybody at another prior time? It wasn't. Right. It hasn't been pushed. And at the end of the day, these are just political measures to kind of get some one-upsmanship, which, again, I'm all for, but at least understand it. I mean, you're on the radio. People listen to you. You know, they don't fall for the trap to say that these are real amendments. They weren't a real amendment.
Tell me the not the legal, but the sort of the political ramifications of this. Trump, today's the day. You heard in the national news for the civil bond deadline, almost a $500 million. Trump's going to come up with to satisfy this bond. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if it'll be continued. I don't know if it will be delayed. I don't know if they work out an agreement where they do it in chunks, or if he comes up with it or not. But what's the political fallout from this?
Well, I'm torn on this. On the political fallout, you know, part of me, this is a good talking point for Donald Trump to talk about. You know, everybody's out to get him, and he's a Democrat trying to take his empire away from him. But, you know, he does himself no service, in my opinion, by coming out and saying that, you know, I've got a $500 million in cash. And his lawyers are filing motions in court to say that he doesn't have the cash. He doesn't have the money to do it. And he can't get these bonds. And he needs time to try to put this financing together. And he comes out and says he has a half a billion in cash. So a judge could theoretically say, oh, you have a half a billion in cash? Then fine, put the money up. And if the cash is sitting there like you say it is, then just put it in. So I'm not going to grant an extension. So I don't think he does himself any good in court with his lawyers. I think he makes his lawyers, the lawyers work a lot harder. But this is theater, too. I mean, Donald Trump saying, well, I was going to put the money, I was going to hold the money to use on my campaign. Well, he didn't spend any money on his campaign in the last election, any of his own money on the campaign. And he spent a pittance of what he said he was going to spend on 2016. So I don't think there's any reason to believe he's going to spend his own money on this election. So it is what it is. It's more drama. I mean, the president can and probably should keep talking about it because politically it's selling to the base and whatnot. The question is it selling to independents? And he's going to have to come back to the middle a little bit to get some independent support if he wants to win.
And that's ironic. In the last week or two, I've been raising the question of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his independent bid. Hard to get on the ballots, cost a lot of money. Now he's making news about who his running mate could be. So I'm noticing that this is continuing, and we'll see if No Labels can come up with a candidate, whether it's Chris Christie or not. Brad Card live on a Monday. Card and Associates, Brad Card live, one of our political analysts and all-stars. Thank you, Brad.
Good, Jack. See you.
Anna Brown, Citizens Count, citizenscount.org, nonpartisan, great group for all the local legislative stuff as we talk about all the national stuff, and there is plenty. Anna Brown gives us a detailed update on the legislative side of things because up in the next few weeks, important votes locally. Anna Brown, good morning.
Good morning, and I feel like when you texted me this morning, I knew instantly what I was going to talk about, so it's all right. I'd love to jump right in. With this week in the House, I feel like the rubber is finally going to hit the road on whether or not the state is going to dip a toe in and really start restricting local zoning regulations. So we've had this housing crisis in New Hampshire that's been building for many years at a critical point now. And there's a discourse that one of the really big causes of this is restrictive zoning. So saying huge lot sizes are required, saying, you know, we're not going to allow multifamily properties in a lot of areas of our towns and so on. And so this makes it also very expensive for builders to build housing if they have to jump through all these different hoops. So this week in the House, there are a few bills related to zoning. And basically, one of them would say, okay, towns have to allow not only one, but two accessory dwelling units. And there are some, you know, restrictions about they can still say certain lot sizes and so on. But nonetheless, really saying accessory dwelling units, that little, you know, shed out back you convert into an apartment, or you converted the lower level of your house and your basement you convert to an apartment, an in-law, those type of situations. And it's really interesting to me because it doesn't break down on party lines. You have some Republicans who are saying, listen, this is how we let the free market, how we let individuals really take hold of the reins here. We got to get rid of zoning. And Democrats also, there are some Democrats who say, listen, this is an affordability crisis. The state needs to take action. We need to get rid of some of this restrictive zoning. But on both Democrat and Republican sides, there are others who say that we need to keep New Hampshire's tradition of local control. What about water supply concerns? What about the character of a town or the schools and so on? So this is going to be the big test, I feel, because this vote is going to show, is there that will to really start pushing back on zoning at the state level or not, because it's a very tricky topic for people of both parties. And then there's a few other bills related to zoning as well. For example, there's a bill that would prohibit zoning regulations that set max parking spaces above one parking space per unit. This would, of course, not stop developers who want to put in more parking spaces per unit, but it would say, okay, you can't have these, you know, three parking spaces per unit or something like that. You know, it has to be at a certain level. And I, once again, similar thing, you know, it's that question of, okay, is this about local control? Is this about getting rid of government regulations? It's a very, very complex debate. So that's probably the biggest issue for me this week, but I'm sure that some people would disagree. Those are votes coming up on Thursday. Also coming up on Thursday, a bill that would establish a system to report information about a person being committed for mental health reasons or found not competent to stand trial, reporting that to the background check system for firearm purchases. This is a bipartisan bill that came forward after the very tragic shooting at New Hampshire Hospital in Concord. Mm-hmm. But it does not have unanimous support from Republicans. It came out of the committee 18-2, but there's also been some rumbling, you know, from very strong Second Amendment supporters saying, listen, we need to protect Second Amendment rights. If someone is, you know, not going to be, you know, if someone commits a crime, that's one mm-hmm. thing, but if someone has a mental health issue, that's something else. So that's another really big bill that's coming up Thursday.
It's interesting because, you know, we have others, I guess, what, next month? Or in April, the whole issue of legalized marijuana will probably make news for a week or so?
The legalized marijuana debate is interesting because I think that at the House at this point, once again, has completely shown that it is very willing and open to pass pretty much any form of marijuana legalization, legalizing just private home growing, legalizing a private market model, legalizing a state-run franchise model. So the bill that they have right now is getting a review in a second committee. And I think the question really is, are they going to pass something out of there that the Senate likes or not? Because the Senate is the real roadblock here. And Senator Daryl Abbas even went into one of these committee meetings and said, listen, this bill in the House will not pass the Senate, but I think if we do that state-run franchise model, I think it can get across the Senate. I think we have the votes there. Mm-hmm. So if the House passes that version, I think it might pass the Senate, but if they're looking to do more of a free market approach, less government control, then I think that it's an uncertain future in the Senate. So that will be coming up for a vote in the coming weeks, but the House vote doesn't interest me so much. I'm curious about when it gets to the Senate.
Yeah, and when Governor Sununu was on my show recently, he kind of echoed his main objections, which were two or three, like how many locations and had to be, you know, strictly controlled. And you know, it seems to me that that if he gets involved ahead of time, in sort of in the making of the final product, maybe, but I still think it's, I know the public opinion's in favor. I just don't see it. I'm not sure it's a slam dunk, but it might be. Certainly in the House it is. But the other one I think was interesting was just a week or so ago, that Sanctuary City bill in the Senate, banning Sanctuary City policies, right down 100% party lines. 14 Republicans, yes, to ban Sanctuary Cities, 10 Democrats, no. But the interesting thing was, why do I feel that you can already feel the advertising, the name, you know, kind of the noise of the gubernatorial race, because you're going to hear Democrats saying that whoever the Republican nominee is, they favor an abortion ban or further restriction on abortion rights over and over, you know, millions of dollars. And on the Republican side, I don't know which senator it was, but one person on the floor last week, and I had both Senator Jeb Bradley, the Republican Senate president, and Lou D'Alessandro on Friday of the show this past week, one of the Democrat leaders talking about this, and he was opposed and Bradley was for, and Bradley's pretty fired up on this Sanctuary City. Well, one of the Democrats said, it's not our job to solve the border crisis. Why do I feel that's a line that's going to come back in an ad?
It might. I think that definitely part of the dispute between Democrats and Republicans right now is what exactly is going on at New Hampshire's northern border, and is this an issue that is at our doorstep or not? And I think that it's also true that the Republicans, on the other hand, are going to kind of do something similar, perhaps, with the abortion debate and say, listen, we're not one of the states where we are refusing a 10-year-old who was raped an abortion. You can get an abortion up to 24 weeks in New Hampshire, and then after that you can if there's, you know, threats to the mother's health or the infant. Right. So I think that the Republic – and so I think both sides are going to try to do that, basically say what you're saying is a huge problem, is not a huge problem in New Hampshire.
But you know you could hurl these assertions and then the other side's on defense. And on the – I don't think it's so much the northern border issue. I think what Bradley is talking about, and I think if – I'm not sure if Kelly Ayotte or Chuck Morse becomes a Republican nominee. My bet is one of the two. But Kelly Ayotte has already come out of the gate saying, you know, we're – you know, we're not going to become Massachusetts, or New Hampshire's not going to become Massachusetts. So when you talk about the border, and we're not here to solve the border crisis, you look at Massachusetts, where they are spending money for more sanctuary cities, and, you know, there are locations and much bigger problem there. So I think it's this feeling almost like running against Massachusetts. Forget the northern border. It's sort of south of us, and I think you're going to see it being made a bigger issue.
Well, I will also throw out there is more nuance to that debate about sanctuary cities as well in terms of local law enforcement resources. How far are they dedicated towards doing federal law enforcement, immigration enforcement, as opposed right. to whatever local crimes there are? And that is not a debate that really gets emphasized or elevated at all. But I think that, once again, you know me, I love to bring it back to that local level, to the New Hampshire level. And I think that would be a very interesting conversation, because I think there is important conversations to be had there about where is the crime coming from in our communities, and how are we best allocating our law enforcement resources. And that kind of seems to be missing to the debate for me a lot of times. I think a lot of times it comes down to, we don't want to be Massachusetts, or the border crisis is being manufactured by Republicans. It's those are the highline national debates that they're catchy. You know, they sound like a jingle, but it's often very more complex.
Well, you and I know the jury in all this is not Republicans or Democrats; it's independent voters. And Democrats nationally and locally are doubling down on this issue and not sort of moving to the middle. And I think independent voters are, every time you see one story, whether it's Lake and Riley in Georgia or a case out of Massachusetts, like Rockland, Mass., the rape of a 15-year-old girl by an, quote-unquote, undocumented person, every time you see one of these stories, it keeps this story red hot, if you follow me. All right, Anna Brown, Citizens Count, citizenscount.org. Make it a great Monday.
Thanks, Jack.
It's Doug Tengden with a World Advisors update here and talking about the snow before we get to the economy. I know it's white gold for a lot of skiers. Last late minute, how much did you get up in the Upper Valley? North Conway, Wildcat, Bretton Woods, about 24 inches.
Yeah, that's about what we got. It just kept coming and coming. It started at midnight, about an inch an hour, and it just kept coming. I got plowed on Saturday at about 10 in the morning. There was about a foot there, and then it just kept coming. I got plowed again Sunday at 5 in the morning, and it was another foot. So yeah, it just very steady. Most snow, a biggest storm I can remember since like February of 2002, when we had a 26 inch storm up here.
Yeah, it was a good one late. Did you get out Saturday or Sunday?
Oh, absolutely. Just on my own property, I just cut a little cross-country trail, just flipped around in the woods here.
Well, I tell you right now, it's here we go. Buckle up. Did you lose power up in the Upper Valley?
We did not lose power. I feel for those folks who did. It's a terrible thing when the snow's coming down and the power goes out. But there wasn't a whole lot of wind, and so the trees didn't come down onto the lines. That's what happens up here in the Upper Valley.
All right. I appreciate it as we get going. What on the economic front, what are we sensing? What are we feeling? Where are things at?
Well, I think the economy is fairly steady here. It's steady, but it's brittle. Some people have described it as marble. It's hard, but I think if something goes, it's going to go. On the other hand, you know, what we're looking at here, what folks are looking at in their pocketbook is they're looking at taxes coming up. And there's all kinds of things to think about when you're looking at taxes. I took my first crack at it, and I thought, oh, my gosh. But then I realized I hadn't included my kids' 1048-Ts in my return, and so I was eligible for the American Opportunity Tax Credit that I hadn't initially calculated. And that makes a big, big difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't tell. I know one thing. It's interesting to see banks starting to market or advertise CDs closer to 5% now. Remember when it was like 0% a couple of years back when the interest, you know, the fixed interest rate was about 2.9?
That's right. That's right. And that does remind me of another thing people need to keep in mind. New Hampshire is not tax-free. It's tax-free for payroll tax. But if you're making if a married couple makes more than $5,000 a year, or an individual makes more than $2,400 a year in interest income, you know, if they've been rolling those CDs and they're like, oh, this is great, no worry, well, they need to get online and file a DP-10 report with the state, because they're going to owe something. And a lot of, since interest rates have risen, a lot of people don't realize, oh my gosh, they don't say, oh my gosh, they don't even know anything, and then the state is the states do something.
You know, this is a question we got for you. I just got a message from a listener, but it really is not. I'm not saying it's your forte, but if you want to take a stab at it, or maybe we can schedule a segment next week. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but 65-year-old, I'm not sure if it's one or two people in the household. They're working part-time, wanting to know if they should start collecting Social Security or wait till the retirement age, which I think she said is 67.
Well, it varies by the person's age, and every circumstance is different. But I'll say this.
Which makes it confusing for people.
It does, but I'll say this. Social Security is increasing by 7 to 8% after inflation with no risk associated with it. And you could say, yeah, but the government's going to cut our benefits, so shouldn't I collect it now? If you start collecting, you're not going to be any better off if you start collecting or if you wait. If there's any exemption, it will be based on age. So everyone will face.
But what about income?
Well, in terms of income, just Social Security.
You get penalized, but they'll cut the amount. I don't mean to speak for her.
Look at it a different way, Jack. Your benefit is your benefit. You've earned it, but it's going to go up after inflation by 8% a year. There is no risk-free investment in the universe that offers an 8% after above inflation return.
Right.
The bond market, not the inflation security market, nothing. So just
I don't know her, and if she wants to call in 603-228-2080, we're tight on time now, but we might have a minute if you want to call. Dorothy. The thing is, though, sometimes I thought if you're, say, 65 in her case, and let's just say you're making more than $50,000 or $75,000 a year, say you're still working full-time and you wanted to collect Social Security, I thought they would deduct. So if your monthly Social Security or your benefit that you've earned, as you said, is, I'm just throwing this out there, $3,500 a month, would she get $3,500 a month if she's working still before her retirement age, or would she get a lesser amount?
She will get what she gets. And then that's going to go up every year. So if her full retirement benefit is $3,500 and she claims it's $65,000, yes, she would be penalized. But that's not the way I look at it. I look at it that at age 62, I had a benefit. At age 63, my benefit went up by 8%. At age 64, my benefit went up another 8% above inflation. So there's
When you say penalized, I'm just curious, what do you mean penalized at 65?
Well, what it means is the way they market it, you've got a full retirement benefit that's guaranteed at age 67.
Right.
But if you take it earlier, then it's lower. If you take it later, then it goes up higher. It's simpler to look at what would I be earned now, and what would I earn in a year, and what would I earn a year after that? That is, if I wait 2 years.
It is. I can see her point, though. It does get complicated because if you're out with friends and you're, you know, having a nacho somewhere and you're just talking about this like a TV commercial or radio commercial, it is complicated because everyone's got a different opinion to tell you. I guess the best thing is, can you contact Social Security and talk to anyone or go to the website, or should you talk to a financial planner or someone like yourself?
Yeah, honestly, it's really best to talk to a financial planner because they have a fiduciary relationship. Social Security has no fiduciary relationship, and if they make a mistake, the most they'll say is, sorry. And you're stuck with what you've done.
Yeah.
So the best thing to do is contact someone who has expertise. And honestly, for me to figure it out, I use software. I use software that takes all the calculations into account because it is really, really complex. I'll just say this to close, Jack. Congress is always marketing. They're always selling. And so they put marketing language into their legislation so that it looks better when they run for re-election.
Oh, politicians. Thank you, Doug. Doug Tengner, worldadvisors.com. Thank you, Doug.
Jack, you have a great week.
Matthew Bartlett, one of our great contributors and political analysts and all-stars, Darby Field Advisors, a great bipartisan firm on public affairs. Matthew, of course, fairly regular with us. Matthew, good morning. I guess the question, in D.C., in the bubble, known as D.C., not New York, not out in, you know, Midwest or the country, how's this civil trial bond case with Trump and this deadline playing, with the showdown with the New York Attorney General, almost $500 million?
Yeah, hey, good morning, Jack. And first, let me just say, happy Greek Independence Day. I'm sure APX Dick Anagnost, me, everybody up at all the Greeks are celebrating. Big, big day. But like you said, I'm down here in the bubble, and people are exhausted. There are still bags under people's eyes from the last food fight for the funding fight. Congress, House, and Senate out for 2 weeks right now. I think everybody hates everybody. But like you just said, Donald Trump is taking to not the campaign trail, but to the courtroom. This is a weird one. This is a judgment where, you know, even people like myself, not big fans of the president, are saying, wait a second, pump the brakes here. What is the crime at hand here? I think your question of, like, what do people think? Well, people that hate Donald Trump hate him even more and are having a great day. People that love Donald Trump love him even more and are saying, I've told you he's been the victim since he came down that staircase. I think right now, you know, not many minds are being changed over this. The question around a cash crunch, not just personally, like was just alluded to, could be remedied by this big SPAC that he's doing that could be worth $3 billion. But yet again, Donald Trump goes out there and says, you know, his lawyers say, we don't have the money for this. This is an outrageous, you know, unjust, crazy judgment. And Donald Trump says, by the way, I got money to cover it. And it's just, and it's one of those things where, you know, people go, don't know what to think.
Well, that's the Trump side where his ego and pride, he's not going to say he doesn't have, you know, that he's going to come up short. I don't know I just think you hit the nail on the head. If you're a Trump supporter, you dig down deeper. They're after him. It's a witch hunt. If you're a Democrat, you're watching him squirm financially and the cost of all the lawyers. But it's the independent voters, and I think a lot of them say this is a witch hunt.
You know, I could be right? We don't know. There's a suite of charges for the former president, some which are very, very, very significant, whether it was appointing his own electors to keep him in power, whether it's classified information, and some, you know, like this one, or more importantly, the one that actually could go to trial before the election, which is the quote-unquote Stormy Daniels, you know, for lack of a better term, trumped-up campaign charges that they've now made into a felony. That could be the only one that goes to trial before this election, and that is probably, you know, the weakest political. If you're Team Trump, that's the one you want to go, because it just seems so flimsy, so flamsy.
It's a lot of news to a lot of people. Let's get back to D.C. You know, the funding bill over the weekend, one Representative Green, you know, wanted to basically pull a McCarthy, if you will, with the House Speaker. What was the reaction on all that?
You know, again, just so typical right now, where, you know, as a conservative Republican, I am so happy when we pass conservative fiscal programs, spending, conservative, you know, smaller government. But boy, it seems lately I have a problem with the so-called conservative members. They seem to want to put, you know, take a hostage and put the gun to their own head or to our own head. It is preposterous. It's what got us into this place. It is why people are checking out left and right. And at some point, you know, if you keep saying we're going to take some bad medicine, you end up poisoning yourself here.
Yeah.
There's a very real chance that a few Republicans go, you know what, I'm just so sick of the drama, and work to, if they try to pull the cord on Speaker Johnson, get a, you know, install a Dem. It's just a very disruptive time, and people are incredibly frustrated and fed up on both sides of the aisle, and even, you know, within the Republican Party.
Matthew Bartlett, Darby Field Advisors. Before I let you go, Matthew, on this Monday, thanks for some political analysis. One of the great ones. I'm looking at this Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and it was ironic in the last week or two. I've been talking about how no one's talking about it in the national news media. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to dignify it. Nothing to see here. Don't do an interview with him, even if he is the son of, you know, Robert F. Kennedy or the nephew of JFK. You know, he's a vaccine, Aaron Rodgers. Don't worry about it. But all of a sudden, I'm looking at, wait a minute. And he's talking about picking his VP pick. And I'm going, you know, he only needs to get on, you know, I mean, a bunch of key state ballots and throws this whole model of Biden and Trump up in the air.
Total wild card. You are correct. If his last name was Robert Smith, no one would be talking about him. But, you know, he's got a couple of famous parents or uncles and you know, born into the right family. I guess that, unfortunately, you know, gives you a spotlight. I remain skeptical about him. the less people know about him, the more they're probably, you know, open. If you remember when he came to the Institute of Politics, boy, every New Hampshire Dem was out there.
Right, right, right.
Then they learned more about him, and they abandoned him very quickly. I know more DeSantis backers that are excited about RFK Jr. than any Democrat.
Well, so it's not the Democrats. It's not the Democrats I'm thinking about. It's independents who are dissatisfied with Biden, Harris, dissatisfied with Trump, and they're looking at it go, you know, I'm going to send a protest vote. And usually I think VP choices don't matter, but when you're sort of a fringe independent candidate, they actually do.
Well, I mean, the word is he'll be announcing it this week. And, you know, the rumors have been circulating that it is Nicole Shanahan, who is the ex-wife of Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, who apparently dated Elon Musk at one point, who helped create and fund the Super PAC ad for the Super Bowl. A very obscure pick. This seems to be a very, you know, obscure ticket. I don't think he's saying, I'm going to win the White House. I think he wants to continue to make a lot of points, which revolve around, like you said, COVID. It's very unclear what this is about still.
It's not obscure, yes, but you got to put some dollar symbols next to the check writing ability of your VP choice. And it changes a lot of things, as it takes money to get on state ballots and signatures, right?
Not only does it take money, but there are very few people. This is a 50-state process to get on the ballot. And like my understanding is there are very few people nationally that know how to get on the ballot in each and every state. So it's still a challenge. It's still probably not even likely that he will actually make the ballot and actually have an impact on these races. And then again, is this a guy that was dreamed up as a torpedo to whack into Joe Biden, or does he turn into a boomerang and kind of come back and hit Donald Trump with some of the independent libertarian leaning voters?
And on that note, no labels. Have you heard? Is it Chris Christie's putting his name out there? What's going to happen there? Because this clock is ticking.
You know, no labels. They say we will pave the runway for a third party. Well, unfortunately, it looks as if, you know, there's still no third party plane. So Chris Christie kind of floated out there. He might be open to it, something of a radical moderate with name ID that can get in there and throw some punches. Again, who does that take from? Very unclear. But I think, like you've been warning and like you've been saying for a long time, hey, man, the clock is ticking, and it seems as if they are losing steam, losing momentum, rather than building. So, I think you've kind of hit it on the head with no labels for a long time now. You know, jury's out, but it's unclear whether or not we get a verdict anytime soon.
Great stuff. Matthew Barrow making a good money. Keep that blood pressure low. There's an opening with Boeing. I think Dave Calhoun, the CEO, is stepping down, so you may have to step in and fill it temporarily. Thank you.
All right. Opa. Bye.
Aaron Rial, NBC News Radio national correspondent on this Monday, and talking about AI and the electric grid. You might want to go easy because some people were without power this morning in New England after 2 feet in the North Country of a dumping of pretty good snow.
Oh, wow. that's a lot. I cannot believe it. We got rain this weekend, but no snow here in Connecticut. But let's talk about the pressures that the grid is going to be under, because what we're seeing is obviously there's more need for electricity, whether it comes from the form of AI or cryptocurrency or just data centers needed to power the AI. We're seeing global estimates for electricity consumption. They're likely to double by 2026. 24 months from now, 2 years, double.
Wow.
So the question becomes, how on earth are the utilities going to bring enough energy generation online? They're stumped, and utilities will have to lean more heavily on natural gas, on coal, on nuclear, even constructing new gas plants to help meet the spike in demand. It doesn't square well, though, with what both tech and utility companies have pledged in terms of their commitments to dramatically reduce their carbon emissions. That's a hard one. It's a hard pill to swallow. You have all of these demands for more electricity, but you can't use traditional methods to get there.
And I wish in the energy side we could have a pragmatic discussion, because it's actually a national security discussion without politics and agendas. But it's impossible to have because, you know, look at New England. We pay some of the highest electricity rates in the country per capita because we're sort of the end of the line. People are even like up in arms over natural gas, one of the cleanest sources of energy. And by the way, it takes gas to make electricity. People don't know that. And we can't even have an honest discussion about it. You can't even raise the specter of nuclear or anything. But, you know, there's a great movie, and you are way too young, as is J-Dog, Aaron, to know what I'm talking about. But Hopefully you've heard of Robert Redford. But there's a great movie called 3 Days of the Condor, which I loved, when he plays like a CIA, not an operative, but an analyst in New York City. And it ultimately comes down to energy, and he uncovers kind of this rogue thing within the agency. And there's a great line at the end when he blows the whistle because they took out his team there. They found something they weren't supposed to. And the guy says, 30 years from now, when Americans want oil and gas cheaply and fresh drinking water, they won't give a damn where they get it. And the guy was right in the movie. I mean, people, they want, amazing thing, people like the lights on at night. They like to be a little warm when it's cold and cool when it's hot, right?
Yeah, we like climate control and lights, that's for sure.
All right, Aaron Rial, NBC News Radio National Correspondent. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks.
Michael Graham, New Hampshire Journal, has a story about this, NAJournal.com. Take it away, Michael.
Well, no, I was actually sharing this with Jack from the New Yorker, where they are no fans of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and they are huge fans of Joe Biden, at least in this election. And yet they say that polling shows right now that RFK Jr. is hurting Biden and helping Trump, you know, based on where we are today. I don't know what the impact is going to be in New Hampshire, because New Hampshire has so many people who love voting against Trump as opposed to voting for RFK Jr. So we'll have to see if it's the same pool of voters. But it's just, New Hampshire is a more affluent, more suburban, more college educated, and more white state than the rest of the country, and so these impacts are different. Kennedy's getting an interesting amount of looks from blue collar workers and from voters of color who are looking at him and saying maybe this is the guy. And of course, what I love is I saw a pollster who said I forget what the percentage is, but it was more than a majority of the people thought that RFK Jr. was in fact RFK. So that's another advantage that he has in this election.
Well, don't kid yourself. A lot of times when John E. Sununu was running
absolutely
for Congress or Senate, they thought it was the old man. Now I think people know Chris Sununu is not his father, but, son. But, hey, I don't want to dwell on this one, but I think it's fascinating, and I'm looking at what else you're catching your eye locally.
Well, I mean, so at NH Journal, as you know, we're one of the few outlets that actually covers what's happening in Washington, D.C. with our delegation. We reported, for example, when Chris Pappas voted in favor of the Lake and Riley Act and helped it pass. 37 Democrats joined the Republicans to pass that bill. Representative Custer voted against. It's a very simple bill. It just says if you've been convicted of burglary, theft, or robbery, which is what the alleged murderer of Lake and Riley had been arrested for and then released because of the sanctuary city policies, you can't become a citizen in the future. You'll never be able to get here legally. That's what all it says. And Senator Shaheen and Senator Hassan, when that amendment came up on the budget, voted against it. And I heard your friend, Mr. Card, say, well, it's all for show, blah, blah, blah. The Lake and Riley Act had already passed the House. It's all it needs is a Senate to vote for it. And Senator Shaheen and Senator Hassan both voted against it. More importantly, they both have been very clear. They oppose deporting people for being in the country illegally. They think that that's wrong. You should not do that. Every other country just about in the world does it. If you go to France and you're on a student visa and you overstay and you get caught down at the Blancmangerie, and you don't have your visa, they send you back to America. Well, Senator Hassan and Senator Shaheen both think that's wrong. They think that you should be allowed to stay illegally as long as you want, unless you break some other law other than our immigration laws. And so that's when Mr. Card complains that this is unfair, blah, blah, blah. No, it reflects the views of our senators. Jack, did you see that the protests are back at the Elbit facility in Merrimack, the Israeli-owned company?
No, I did not.
You did? Oh, my God. You've got to read the story, Jack. These knuckleheads brought cars. They drove cars, old junkers, and then they cut holes in the door and then chained themselves through the hole in the door with the handcuffs and stuff. So that it made it very difficult to remove them.
Isn't that what they invented? Jaws for life?
Well, my approach would be just to snip off the arm, make it.
No, no, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. But I mean, who are these people?
Chainsaws to cut the restraints.
Wait a minute. Who are these people?
was going to say, just like the last time where we have four people who've been charged with felonies, all of them from out of state, mostly Massachusetts, all of these people are from out of state too, mostly from Maine. One is from California. And they made a very big stink to their spokesperson of saying that New Hampshire and its the racists of New Hampshire only charged the previous protesters to try to scare us away. Well, it's not going to work. And so they are say they're going to keep coming back. And I say that Attorney General Formella, who's, by the way, handling these cases personally, is more than happy to charge these people with felonies and send them to prison, too. He has no problem whatsoever, enforcing the law.
Your lead story, New Hampshire Journal, Cindy Warmington, Democrat candidate for governor, says no to ban on sanctuary cities and yes to a ban, if elected, on assault weapons. Elaborate on that. That was from a WMUR interview.
She was on your old stomping grounds, Jack, WMUR. And was asked of where she is on the sanctuary cities bill. And she said, first of all, she doesn't support New Hampshire becoming a sanctuary state. But she also doesn't support the state doing what the legislation that Jeb Bradley's talking about, which would stop Manchester, Laconia, Portsmouth, whatever, from becoming sanctuary cities. So she opposes stopping them. So she opposes the ban. And then he asked, well, how would gun laws change if you become governor? And she mentioned several things, including red flag laws. And she reiterated, as she has in the past, her support for a, quote, assault weapons ban, which in her definition of assault weapon, because as you know, Jack, there's no such thing as a, quote, assault weapon. She would include AR-15s, which are the most popular rifles and are manufactured in part in New Hampshire.
Yep. All right, Michael Graham on a Monday.
Jobs for real workers. In New Hampshire, we have the highest per capita number of jobs in gun manufacturing of any state in the union, and Cindy Warmington wants to be governor and ban the sale of the products that these workers are making.
Somehow I don't think the story will be written that way, but I hear you. It speaks loud.
Well, I mean,
thank
that's just
you.
The facts. It's not a story. It's just the facts.
Michael Graham, NA Journal. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Tom Raffio, President and CEO of Northeast Delta Dental, Delta Dental Radio. Stories from the Starting Line. Hopefully you were out there taking advantage of some of that Mother Nature and the snow this weekend.
I got a few runs in on Saturday. I couldn't do it Sunday because, which was great, by the way, but I couldn't go Sunday because this is part of my good news. We had the Manchester City, I think you understand this, they have a tradition of doing their St. Patrick's race and parade a week later than most communities. So at 11 o'clock, we had the St. Patrick's Day run, which I did with Ellen and our granddaughter Havana. Then we stuck around for the parade, which started a little bit after noon. And my God, that parade went on forever, Jack. So, and of course, my five-year-old wanted to stay for the whole thing. So I got to see this wonderful parade. And, there's so many good causes are promoted. It also afforded me the opportunity. There was one section where all of our political leaders were. So right in the same group, we had Representative Chris Pappas, Senator Maggie Hassan, gubernatorial candidate Kelly Ayotte, gubernatorial candidate Joyce Craig, and then the new mayor of Manchester, Jay. So I was able to say hi to all of them. But this is quintessential New Hampshire, Jack, because, right there, you see all of the political leaders that probably in most states, people don't have access like that.
Good stuff, yeah, and that's important. And I think your board, Tom, is to be commended, what you've done. And you're also helping. You got to be with us on May 15th, right, for Veterans Count.
Yep.
Make 12 hours count.
Definitely, we're a big supporter of Easter Seals and Veterans Count. And for my veterans friends, I'm getting 5 to 10 calls a week. Just give me a call at 223-1300. Generally, Dr. Mitch Carey calls you back the same day. So if you're not eligible for the VA, which is most veterans because of the congressional rules, and if you're not eligible for Medicaid, then you can be part of our program. And as you mentioned, I have a very generous board that supports it to the tune of $300,000 in New Hampshire and $300,000 in May in Maine. And that's why last week I called in on Thursday, not Friday, because I had board meetings Thursday and Friday, Thursday afternoon through Friday afternoon. And my board is so supportive of all of this mission-sensitive activity. And that includes not just oral health, but population health, you know, mental health, and just a tremendous support that I get that allows me to get out there. And then Friday night, when everything else was done, we had a meeting of all invited Medicaid members to give us, you know, real-time feedback. So a few of us were at 2 Delta talking and answering questions from Medicaid members, and that program is going really, you know, really well. The thing that we're doing now is we're having a mobile dental clinic every week. And this past weekend in the North Country, we had to postpone Saturdays, but we did it on Sunday, and it was definitely well attended. This weekend coming up, which is Easter, is the only weekend we're not having the mobile dental clinic. So on that front, we're doing well. And then Saturday morning, I'll talk about this on Friday, but we're hosting a race here at 2 Delta for Dana-Farber. One of my running friends, Beth Conley, has run Boston for many years, and they use it as a fundraiser for Dana-Farber. So, you know, the great thing about New Hampshire, and you know this, Jack, and you taught me about, you know, about the veterans, you can make things happen, and you don't have to wait, you know, for governmental solutions, although those are nice too, by the way. So, and Story from the Starting Line is going well. Just Sunday at the race, a bunch of people said, oh, God, I just read a new chapter to it. So,
how many, do you even have a handle, Tom Raffio, how many road races you do a year or that are groups and communities that you help back or support? And of course, the big ones, Mount Washington, but I'm talking the small town road races that are really community events on a Saturday morning.
We sponsor just about every road race in New Hampshire, and there are several every weekend. So probably the dollars there is another $300,000. And the reason why that's important is most road races, the monies are going toward charity, sometimes rural health, sometimes not. And so I'd rather have the smaller organization take the registration fees and have that applied to their charity as opposed to, you know, paying for the timing service. So generally our sponsorships for the smaller races pay for the timing, and then all the registration fees can go to the charity. So, yeah, hundreds and $300,000 was how I would answer that question.
Well, keep going. You make a huge difference, we think.
Yeah, no, and thanks for the opportunity on the radio front, because that's really gotten the word out on the veterans. So keep up the great work, Jack, and we'll talk Friday.
Well, it's all about community. So thank you, Tom. Make it a great Monday.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.